Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
There have been these studies that show that almost half the children lack the will to live. They have a kind of permanent despair about their life.
We spend the half hour with Richard Falk, UN Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian territories. The problem is he can't enter Gaza or any other part of the Israeli-occupied territories he was assigned to work on. He also can't enter Israel because he believes the leadership does not like what he has said about the rights of Palestinians. When Barack Obama takes the oath of office in January, his hand will be on the same Bible Abraham Lincoln used back in 1861. This symbolic gesture about the president who is said to have freed the slaves is clearly designed to remind Americans of advances in human and civil rights. But the media has moved on from their exhaustive coverage of Barack Obama's progressive pastor, his racial background, support from Oprah Winfrey. They are now focusing on Obama's choice of Reverend Rick Warren for an inaugural presentation. Warren set off controversy after making harsh comments about gays, and CNN and other television networks are taking advantage of this new opportunity to do he said, she said coverage. CNN interviewed right-wing pastor Pat Robertson, for example. AP, the Associated Press, quoted singer-songwriter Melissa Etheridge, who says she was impressed by Warren's warmth during a recent encounter. That warmth is progress. Warren compared gays to child abusers. Etheridge and her wife, Tammy Lynn Michael, have now agreed to attend the inauguration despite some misgivings. It is newsworthy that gays feel worried. Their rights are at issue when it comes to seeing spouses in hospital or receiving equal pay and benefits to be shared with partners. But compare this daily news coverage of the issue of Warren to CNN, AP, Fox, or MSNBC coverage of the steady loss of life in Gaza due to Israel's cutting off of power, water, medical supplies, food, and petrol. The civil and human rights of dying civilians, many of them children, may never be the kind of topic that receives such exhaustive coverage with multiple points of view being analyzed and reanalyzed. The blockade for Gazans is mirrored by a blockade in U.S. news coverage of their plight. In fact, the humanitarian emergency in Gaza has become so dire that normally staid UN officials and members of the non-governmental organization or NGO world are speaking out against what Israel is doing. That includes UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Upon arrival at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, Israel, Richard Falk expected delays, perhaps a security search. But Israeli security services instead detained him and put him in a holding room with about 20 others experiencing entry problems. At this point, he wrote in a special to The Guardian, quote, "I was treated not as a UN representative, but as some sort of security threat, subjected to an inch-by-inch body search and the most meticulous luggage inspection I have ever witnessed." Israel then refused to allow Falk to do his job for the UN in the occupied territories, Palestine. He was promptly deported. Richard Falk is professor of international law at Princeton University. He remains the UN's special rapporteur on the Palestinian territories. Richard Falk, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
I want to start by asking you first to describe your reasons for the call you made to the ICC, International Criminal Court, that they would investigate Israel's violation of the truce November 4th. What else did you ask for in that call? What are your complaints and concerns?
That was an appeal based on my sense that the occupation policies as applied to Gaza gave continuing cause for concern that the collective punishment that was associated with imposing a very punitive siege on the entire territory constituted what seemed to me to be a crime against humanity. And that fell within the scope of the International Criminal Court's mandate. Now, whether in fact there was a basis for asserting jurisdiction, I'm not sure about. I think that would be a more technical question as to whether some of the victims policies were national in some way of a party to the treaty that set up the court. That's a sort of technical lawyer's question that I didn't attempt to answer.
Now, just talk about the blockade and this collective punishment, which you have described as massive. Why is collective punishment criminal? I mean, who sees that tactic as criminal? And what are some of the consequences for Palestinians?
The prohibition on collective punishment is embedded in international humanitarian law. And most relevantly for this set of issues, it is contained in Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention regulating occupation, belligerent occupation of a foreign territory. And there's very little legal doubt that collective punishment is not a permissible tactic, even if it is justified by security considerations. And here, there is no relevant security link to justify this kind of tactic. It's always been something that has been treated as very objectionable when any form of punitive action is taken not against those who are alleged to be the perpetrators, but against the civilian population as a whole. For instance, in Gaza, every child, every old person, every sick person is subject to the effects of this blockade that have restricted the flow of food, fuel, and medical supplies to such an extent that the population is barely able to physically survive. Recent statistics have been showing that over 80% of the Gazan population lives below the UN poverty threshold set at $1 of purchasing power per day, and 46% of the children in Gaza are suffering from acute anemia. There are many other indications of deteriorating health and the real increasing vulnerability of the population there to disease and other kinds of terrible results of this continuing blockade.
The United States has been negotiating now with organizations and individuals that it once saw as enemies of the U.S. military operation in Iraq. What could American forces teach the Israeli military leadership and security services and politicians in Israel right now about the way negotiations calmed some of the violence in Iraq? I know things aren't perfect there, but there is a lesson there, right?
Yes, I think that's an interesting observation. I'm not sure. In Iraq, the United States definitely wanted to pursue a policy that led to stability and ultimately to peace in order to create a situation where it could withdraw, or substantially withdraw at any rate. I'm not sure what the Israeli motivations are with respect to Gaza and the West Bank, because they've continued to expand their settlements, which are also unlawful, on the West Bank. And they do not seem to be interested in really achieving a negotiated outcome that gives the Palestinians a viable state of their own, and therefore this may serve their purpose to keep the conflict at some level of intensity so that there isn't much attention given to the fact that they are continuing to expand the settlements which they agreed to freeze when the so-called peace process at Annapolis was initiated in December of 2007.
And what about your timing, Richard Falk, in making these statements about the imposition of the blockade, about Israel's policies? Do you see this as an opportunity, as both the U.S. and Israel are undergoing political change, but also maybe the world is ready to put aside some of the emotion about 9/11 and proceed with some changes in policies that could lead to peace and economic prosperity. I mean, let's face it, we're all struggling now.
Yes, I think that the context is appropriate for some kind of fundamental shift in relation to this long festering conflict between Palestine and Israel. My timing was less connected to that context than was my concern about the deteriorating situation, especially in Gaza, but also to some extent in the West Bank. I consider it my role not so much to take advantage of a more opportune political context as to be a truthful reporter on the facts as I can understand them and to relate those facts to my understanding of the relevant legal obligations of Israel as the occupying power.
Well, you've also written about secrecy here, the problem that the outside world knows so little of what's going on in Gaza. Just talk about that in the context of arguments that Israeli authorities will be making during any peace talks being discussed in either Turkey or Egypt.
Well, yes, I think that's a very important feature of Israeli occupation policy recently. They have made it very difficult for qualified observers within Gaza to leave, those who are connected with human rights NGOs or are students that have fellowships to study abroad. They've been denied exit permits. And then people like myself who seek to enter and give a credible account of what is happening have increasingly been denied entry. So this is a kind of policy that seeks to make the situation as opaque as possible, and it is my job, I guess, to do the opposite, to make it as transparent as possible. And the reliance on secrecy, of course, is the most extreme form of opaqueness and does prevent the international community from understanding and perceiving the reality as it exists.
In what way does that problem of secrecy, a lack of reporting by the international press, also affect the United Nations in their role as brokers of peace? I understand that even UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon complained that his pleas that Israel allow food and supplies in for starving Palestinians have been ignored.
Yes, that's quite correct and disturbing. It is perhaps the first time in the history of this conflict that has now gone on over six decades that such strong statements have been made by the leading officials of the UN. And that does express, I think, the seriousness of the situation and the frustrations that are felt because of the lack of cooperation on the part of Israel. It's very hard for the UN to be too critical of Israel because Israel has been consistently protected from criticism by the U.S. government, which is the most influential member of the U.N., and the funding of the U.N. is dependent on the willingness of the United States to continue its level of financial support. So there's a lot of leverage, and when these kinds of statements are made, it is an expression of the desperation and urgency of the situation that explains it, and it should serve as an indication that the UN is having difficulty even fulfilling this minimum responsibility, which is to try to sustain the survival of the population, especially in Gaza. Actually, the UN has a deeper responsibility because it originally was in a position to succeed the British mandate that had been held over Palestine and attempted to solve the problem way back in 1947 by part petitioning that mandate and giving the Palestinian side at least 45% of the disputed territory. Now, what the Palestinians are seeking is only 22% of that original Palestine, and still having no success in obtaining a viable political future, even on that very small part of the original disputed territory.
You've also commented that Karen Abizaid, who heads the UN relief effort in Gaza, has talked about the desperate urgency and unacceptable conditions facing the civilian population of Gaza. And you've pointed out that she has also said that a flurry of denunciations by normally cautious UN officials has not occurred on a global level since the heyday of South African apartheid. These kinds of words must be hard for Israelis to deal with. I mean, they have strong censorship there, and of course, you were detained and deported after writing those words, right?
Yes, of course, they didn't connect the dots explicitly. Whether that why I was detained and expelled has not been given a clear explanation beyond the fact that they objected to my appointment in the first place and contended that I was biased against Israel in relation to the occupied territory, a claim that I, of course, deny. My argument is essentially that I'm trying to be truthful about the conditions that exist, and I'm happy to have a debate about the accuracy of what I'm saying. Part of what Israel has attempted to do all along is to shift attention from the realities of the occupation to the qualifications of those that observe that reality. And they've been quite successful in playing this mind game that shifts all the discussion onto the question of whether the person who is making the report has some bias, rather than trying to say that what is reported is false or misleading, which would be, of course, in my view, a legitimate subject of debate.
And then it's your job to look out for the humanitarian concerns of the civilian population. That's what you were sent there to do, right?
Yes. In a more literal sense, I was asked to evaluate whether the occupation policies are consistent with human rights standards and the duties of an occupying power under international humanitarian law. And my reports that are supposed to be given to the UN General Assembly and to the Human Rights Council in Geneva have focused on those aspects of the occupation.
You've said an estimated 230 Gazans died last year because they were denied proper medical care. Some of them spent long hours at Israeli crossing points and were refused entry into Israel. But you've provided some details here about the fact that children are going deaf because of the explosions. There's no kidney dialysis. There's no medicine for cancer patients. There's no CT scanners. Sophisticated medical equipment is not available. Just basic drugs and medicine, just not available to the general population. We're talking about more than 1 million people, right?
Yes, 1.5 million.
And many of them children under the age of 12 who are now, you say, undergoing periods of such terrible stress and despair that even kids under the age of 12 losing the will to live. Just go over some of the hard facts that you've had to deal with in making all of these choices to be so outspoken.
It is disturbing, of course, and there is increasing confirmation by reliable studies of both mental and physical health of the civilian population, especially the most vulnerable elements of that population, children, older people, and sick people who, as you say, have depended on medical treatment that requires sophisticated machinery that needs electricity. And the electricity in Gaza is only available for parts of each day. And effective, consistent treatment of the sort that some of the terminally ill patients require. And that's part of the reason that many of these people have sought to get treatment outside of Gaza and have had such difficulty gaining exit permits to enable that treatment to take place. But you have to imagine the enormous stress that children experience growing up under these conditions. And there have been these studies that show that almost half the children lack the will to live. They have a kind of permanent despair about their life. And the more promising young people who have managed to persist in studying under these difficult conditions, even obtaining foreign fellowships, are then denied the right to leave to pursue their study, which seems to be a policy that wants to preclude any sort of positive future for Palestinian society, because obviously the future of Palestine depends on having educated young persons able to play an important role in this modern world that we're living in, and that requires higher education. And to deny these young people that opportunity seems to me to be a punitive policy that has no justification and does suggest that Israeli motivations are not guided by security considerations.
Richard Falk, I want to refer to a report that came out Monday, December 22nd, 2008. This is from the World Bank, and they issued a strong warning that Gaza is on the brink of collapse, and that actually the blockade, they say, is fueling the growth of a black market controlled by Hamas. This seems to work against the goals that are being stated by Israel's foreign minister, Tzvi Lipsy, by others there involved in the political fight for power for the prime minister's seat, like Benjamin Netanyahu. Don't they want Hamas to be weaker? I mean, they've talked about dividing Hamas. Here, the black market seems to be growing, and Hamas seems to be gaining support. Again, this seems to be going in the wrong direction, doesn't it?
You would think so. It's very difficult to interpret Israeli behavior because it doesn't seem to correspond to any sort of simple logic, as you suggest. You would think that the object was to undermine Hamas, but the blockade has made the population much more dependent than they otherwise would have been on Hamas. Now, some people have suggested that this is part of a policy that is designed to make Gaza much more associated with Egypt and to relieve Israel of any future responsibility, because most of the supplies that do get into Gaza come through these tunnels that are connecting Gaza with Egypt, and which Israel is obviously allowing to exist. They know these tunnels, their location. And that, too, is a bit puzzling, why they maintain the blockade but don't do anything to disrupt the tunnels on the southern borders of Gaza. And it's uncertain what is the real motivation. Maybe it is partly to establish the understanding that since Gaza is so dominated by Hamas, it is reasonable for Israel to refuse to deal with Gaza and maybe even to separate Gaza from the West Bank and make any Palestinian entity even more of a mini-state than it otherwise would be. It's hard, in other words, to know exactly what lies behind this policy because it's never explicitly acknowledged.
What kind of new vision is there for the people of Gaza, Palestinians in general, that they can be more in the news, that they can have finally a truce with Israel that lasts toward a real peace and a sharing of this territory?
Well, I think that's the whole purpose that I see of my own role, is to suggest that there is a foundation for a more peaceful future for the Palestinians and also for the Israelis, but it depends on upholding at a minimum this legal regime that is incorporated into international law. It hasn't been widely observed that Hamas has consistently offered Israel a long-term truce and indeed a virtually permanent cessation of conflict if a end to the occupation could be achieved. And even in the present circumstances, there was a short-term truce negotiated about 6 months ago through Egypt's diplomatic auspices, and that held quite well until just a couple of weeks ago. Israel broke the truce by using force to kill some Palestinians in an act which was a quite flagrant violation of the truce, and that led to a Hamas response by way of rockets, which, as I've also indicated, is an unlawful and immoral tactic on the part of the Palestinians. It's something of a crime of survival, but still it is a crime and should be condemned as such. But my point is that there is the possibility for a long-term end to the violence and a gradual political transformation for both people. But this depends, it seems to me, primarily on Israel's willingness to relinquish the settlement expansion process, also to end the expulsion of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, and generally to create an atmosphere that would allow the Palestinians to have their own separate state, including a capital in Jerusalem, and that would also mean that Israel would have to substantially dismantle the settlements that have been built on the West Bank. So there are possibilities, but there are many obstacles, and the main obstacle to realizing a vision of justice and peace for the Palestinians and the Israelis lies in the continuing unwillingness of Israel to give up the advantages that have come to it through the occupation, especially of the West Bank, and especially in relation to the settlements that have been established there. A lasting peace between the two peoples is the only way of resolving the conflict, and that depends on giving the Palestinians a viable state of their own.
Thank you so much for joining us, Richard Falk.
Well, thank you, Doris, for having me.
Richard Falk is the special rapporteur or reporter on the situation of human rights on Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. We will post a link to his statement issued December 9th, just prior to his arrival in Tel Aviv, at our website talknationradio.org. Authorities in Tel Aviv, acting on behalf of the Israeli government, first detained Richard Falk, then deported him. His story, The Siege of Gaza, was published in The Guardian, and we'll post a link to that as well. Richard Falk issued a call to the ICC, International Criminal Court, asking for an investigation into Israel's violations of a truce with Hamas. He is a professor of international law at Princeton University. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com.